And now with me here in the studio is the one and only Morgan Fairchild, who's in town to perform at the New Theater Restaurant production of Murder Among Friends. It opens August 27th and runs through early November. And Morgan, welcome back to Kansas City.
Oh, thank you, Steve. Nice to be back.
And you are back because you were here a long time ago, right? Back in the early 70s, if you can remember.
Tiffany's Who can attic. Remember?
I can't. Maybe you can.
Yeah. I was here in 1972 and opened Tiffany's Attic for Dennis and Richard and the producers who were doing this play, who owned the New Theater. And I gather Tiffany's doesn't exist anymore, but it was a wonderful time.
Remember it?
Oh, yeah. I remember it like it was yesterday.
But you weren't Morgan Fairchild as we know you today back
in the early
70s.
I still had to get on a daytime soap and go through a lot of changes and things. But then I was back here again also with Gentlemen Prefer Blondes in the 80s on a big tour. So
that's right.
So I have fond memories of Kansas City. Everybody's always so friendly and nice and that good Midwestern hospitality.
You know, one thing about you that really struck me just following you on Twitter this week is you really pay very close attention to the news. You're very engaged. It's very clear. We just talked about Ferguson and what happened over there. What do you make of it all?
Well, I think it's a very unfortunate situation all around. It's unfortunate for the family of this young man, obviously for this young man, for Michael Brown, and for the community. And there are obviously some things that need to be addressed in engagement within the community. A couple of the issues that I also think have come up because of this are freedom of the press, and that you don't arrest reporters sitting in a McDonald's for
Not
doing their jobs,
idea.
You know, and you don't tear gas other video reporters, and you don't take people's cell phones away from them and tell them that they can't video the police, whatever they're doing. And also the militarization of some of the police departments is becoming a bit of a concern in America, I think. Going over many years now, there have been military-grade equipment given to local police departments, but without a lot of the training that would go with it to make sure it's not used in an overly heavy-handed way.
You know, over the years, Morgan, you've been involved in so many different causes, AIDS. You've sat with Al Gore and talked about global warming, obviously concerned about the environment. Where's your main focus these days when it comes to a cause that you're still very, very much involved in?
Well, I stay involved with whatever causes I get into. It's just on AIDS and global warming. I was a very early activist on them. One of my hobbies is emerging viruses and epidemiology, and so I'd been following this new virus since 1980, when it was just cluster cases of Kaposi's sarcoma in New York and 13 cases of pneumocystis pneumonia in San Francisco. And when it came out that it was all gay men, I knew something new was out there. So I just followed it, ended up working a lot with Surgeon General Koop at the time and helping form the AIDS Task Force in Hollywood and testifying before Congress to get AIDS funding and there for the unveiling of the first quilt. A lot of things to get it treated as a disease, not as a stigma, to just get rid of the stigma factor and get it addressed as a disease, which is the way. I'm a science nerd. This is the way you go about it.
But as you look back on it, I mean, how successful were you and others like you who worked so hard on that cause? Because we're in a very different place today, it seems to me.
I think overall we were very successful because today it's treated like a disease. Yeah. Today there is research going on. Today they are doing a lot of genetic research and all kinds of things to see who has a resistance to it. I mean, it's like there's so many different ways. And the sidebar to that is that they have now realized that viruses can cause cancer. Mm-hmm. That was virology was sort of an area of science. It was being abandoned before the AIDS came along, and they looked at it to see but they didn't have the technology at the time.
Right.
So they dismissed it as a cause of other diseases. Now they realize that viruses can cause cancer, and that's opened up a whole new area of research, too. So I feel that we did do what we needed to do, which was get the funding, get the research going, take the stigma off of it, get drugs that could treat it. We still don't have a cure. We still don't have a vaccine. But we're closer to some of those than we ever have been.
Well, where does the science nerd part of you come from? Your mom
and
dad?
Oh, that's the real me.
Is it?
Oh, yeah. I wanted to be a doctor or a paleontologist when I was a kid, so I just kept my hand in always. I mean, they just invited me to the documentary. I was here, so I couldn't go to the premiere of the documentary on Sue, the Tyrannosaurus, the largest Tyrannosaurus that's ever been excavated, because people know. I mean, back in the 80s, Michael Crichton and I were the two sort of go-to people at the Museum of Natural History on paleontology. He had just written Jurassic Park.
Right.
And at that time, the Museum of Natural History in L.A. was very excited because they had their first exhibit that was going to travel to the Smithsonian instead of the other way around, of moving dinosaurs. And I did the ad for them that traveled with the exhibit to each city. So it was one of those things where I did an ad with an Allosaurus behind me and stopped traffic the day we were shooting, trying to get that Allosaurus across town. So for people who don't know, an Allosaurus looks a great deal like a Tyrannosaurus.
I'm visiting with Morgan Fairchild. So where did you go so wrong in your life that you wound up with a career in Hollywood as opposed to doing something in science?
Well, I couldn't make a book report in the fifth grade. I was always in advanced placement classes. I was in advanced placement classes, but mostly they would let you write a book report. And in the fifth grade, this teacher had it in her head that I must give an oral book report. Everybody had to do it orally. And I stood in front of the classroom for 3 days, and nothing would come out. I was just frozen. And my mother, her brother was a lawyer and a judge, and she and he went through high school and college being debaters, and she was just determined no child of hers was not going to be able to stand up and make their thoughts known. And so she enrolled us in drama classes, and I would throw up every Saturday before we had to go.
Kidding.
And my sister would just love it. She loved it. She was always the big personality kid. I was the shy, quiet one. And but then at the end of the year, they had us do a play. And I got to play the adult because I was the little old fuddy-duddy in the group. And I figured out that I kind of liked the play. And then one Saturday morning, my mother got up, and there was a very good group in Dallas at that time called the Junior Players Guild that put on shows for kids.
Yeah.
But they didn't use kids in them much, but they tried to use a few. So they were going to be having auditions. So my mother said, "We're going to these auditions." And I'm like, "No." And my sister's, "Oh, fun." You know? So we go to this audition. We sit in the back of this auditorium all day watching kids do improvs, you know, up there, that they were just whatever, being witches at cauldrons and stuff. And I thought, boy, I could do better than that. But I wouldn't go down there. And finally, my sister said, "I want to do it." You know, so she goes down an audition. Well, I knew at that point that if I didn't go down an audition, my mother would scream at me all the way home. I mean, I have a career today because my fear of the stage is second only to my fear of my mother.
Wow. Wow.
But she was always so supportive and, you know, just drove us to rehearsals, gave up so much of her life and took us to rehearsals, took friends to rehearsals. I mean, I have friends from that era who say they have careers now because my mother was willing to come get them and take them to rehearsal when their own mothers thought it was stupid.
And at what point did the light bulb for you, Morgan, sort of go off and you thought, by George, I like this stuff?
Well, I mean, I knew I liked it, and people were foolish enough to keep hiring me to do it.
Yeah.
So starting when I was very young, I was always doing that. And when I was about 16, I'd been working on Bonnie and Clyde, and I was doing a show. I was doing Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum at Night and sort of going to high school when I could. And I asked one of my friends who was kind of a mentor, who was an older guy who was hysterical, second only to Robin Williams as a comic genius. And I said, you know, do you think I could do this for a living? And he gave me the best piece of advice anyone can give a kid. He said, if there's anything else in the world you can do and be happy, do that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
He said that. Why?
Because I think it's such a hard life. It's so difficult to make a living in, and so many people fail at it, that unless you really love it for it and you love the process and you love the creativity of it, it's so much easier to go do something else that's more solid and more dependable and that you can actually make a living at and support a family.
I mean, it's amazing to me. You clearly love it because you're still doing it. And if you look over your...
Oh, honey, my typing skills are terrible.
Well, but you're still doing film. You're still on TV. You've got a Hallmark movie coming out here
On paper on Hallmark Channel September 20th. I'm sure they'd love for
but
me
you're
to...
But you're just going and going and going. Why are you still going so hard?
I love it. I love it. As long as they'll hire me to do it, I love doing it. I love theater. I grew up in the theater since I was a little kid. You know, I love the process. I love the camaraderie. I love acting. I love making people laugh. I love engaging people. I love
the
process.
But it's hard. As you said, it's hard.
Well, the business side of it is hard.
You're here at the new theater. You got to memorize the whole thing. Here you are.
Oh, yeah.
It's
the
work.
Second act is facing me when I get to rehearsal today.
Yeah. And Rob, who's sitting next to you, they work you at the new theater. This is a big commitment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All September, all October, and into November?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a big time commitment, but I love Dennis and Richard. Mm-hmm. I have such fond memories of them from the time when I was here before. And when they this spring, the agency called, we were going over some projects, were offered some different things. And at the end of this list of things that we were discussing, they said, oh, and there's a play. And I said, oh, a play. Where's it? Where? And they said, Kansas City. I said, Kansas City. I've played Kansas City. I said, I played there, God, when I was a kid. And they said the names, you know, and Dennis Hennessy and Richard Crothers. I said, these are the guys I worked with when I was a kid. And they're great guys. They're so nice. I had such a good time. So I said, well, let's talk about it. Let's really talk about it. So that's how I ended up doing it. I'm just, and Dennis is directing this time, which will be great.
There you go.
Yeah, we're having a great time. We've got a really great cast. I'm so lucky they put together a really great cast, and we're having a really good time. So
that's great.
I'm very fortunate.
Well, you're bringing up so many things I wanted to ask you about. You've already mentioned Bonnie and Clyde. That was your first acting job. You were a double.
Well, no, it wasn't my first acting job. It was my first
movie job
I worked on.
Okay,
yeah.
You were a double for the great Faye Dunaway during location filming on Bonnie and Clyde, which came out in 67. What did that job entail? What did you do on that film?
I didn't know what we were going to do. I was getting ready to open A Funny Thing Happened to the Way to the Forum, and I was on my way out the door to go to the theater, and a fella called who owned a lot of the sound stages in town. So I knew him because I'd been doing commercials and things like that. And he called out of the blue and said, you want to be in a movie? And I said, oh, okay, sure. And he said, well, okay, be at the North Park Inn tomorrow morning at 5 a.m. 5 a.m.? I'm just getting ready to opening night. I'm not going to get until late.
Yeah.
And he said, well, that's the deal. You got to be there at 5 a.m. So I said, well, all right. You know, I had no idea what it was. And so then as I'm getting off the phone, he says, can you drive stick shift? And I said, sure. Like all actors, I lie.
Of course.
So I got to the theater and I took a couple of the young guys. I said, hey, you got to teach me how to drive a stick shift in the alley behind the theater on intermission.
Yeah.
So I'm back there trying to learn to drive shift. I didn't know it was a period picture. I didn't know anything about it. So
well, for the record, I would have taught Morgan Fairchild how to drive stick. I would have been right there too. Yeah. No problem. Yeah.
So, you know, the next morning I show up in the dark. They put us on a big bus. We're driving out to the middle of Texas, nowhere, you know, which is in Texas, middle of nowhere is really middle of nowhere. And put us out. The sun's just starting to come out. We're out in the plains, not too many trees. Everything's dirt roads. And I didn't know what I was doing. And so somebody said, oh, why don't you go down and look at the set? There's a house down the road there. That's going to be the location. I said, okay. You know, so I start walking down this dirt road, and I'm walking and walking and walking. And there's like nobody, and there's no house. And I'm just starting to think, boy, were they kidding me? They're just having me on because I'm a kid and I don't know anything.
Yeah.
So finally, I see this guy walking toward me, sort of silhouetted with the sun coming up behind him, kind of shuffling along, head down, hands in his pockets. And so I said, excuse me, sir, is this the way to the set? And he looks up and he says, why, yes, it is. Let me show you. It's Warren Beatty.
Well, of course he wanted to show you.
At 28, I'm the most gorgeous man I've ever seen in my life.
Is that right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
With the sun coming up behind him, I mean, it's just
why
somebody's
not?
Dream, you know. So anyway, so I ended up doing all of that. So a lot of the distant shots of Bonnie or driving in a car or riding in a car, it's not really Faye, it's me. And, you know, it was a fun way because I was there every day. I met everybody. I hung out with everybody. It was like Gene Hackman's third movie, Gene Wilder's first movie, Faye Dunaway's maybe third movie.
I forgot Gene Hackman was in that film.
Yeah. And, you know, and it was just such a creative process. That's when I thought, I love theater, but I love movies. I want to do this.
Did you have any sense at that moment that Bonnie and Clyde was going to become the seminal American film?
Oh, no, nobody did. Like with most movies, you go off and make it and do the best you can and hope for the best. And Warren pushed it very hard. He pulled it back when they weren't promoting it right and selling it right and took it back out. I mean, Warren really deserved the credit for getting that to be a cult classic. But nobody knew. You know, nobody knew. It was a period picture. Nobody knew much about it.
Yeah.
I knew who Bonnie and Clyde were because I grew up in Dallas, you know, but a lot of people didn't know who they'd been. So it was, you know, it was always fun. You never know you're going to be in a classic. I mean, I did Pee Wee's Big Adventure. We didn't know it was going to take off and be a cult classic.
I
want
to ask you about that one, too. Yeah. Again, Morgan Fairchild is our guest. She's appearing in a new production at the New Theater Restaurant coming up later on this month. You've already mentioned Robin Williams. I'm skipping around here just a little bit. But you've been on a lot of media talking about him because you were with him very early on when he began Mork and Mindy. And you tell such a great story about spotting him. I talked in the opening about your ability to spot talent. You spotted him early on, and you knew right away this was somebody extraordinary.
Well, I had done Happy Days. It was like maybe my third or fourth job when I got to L.A. And it was such a great cast. And Gary Marshall's so great, and the cast was so great. So whenever I'd be on the Paramount lot, either shooting or auditioning or something, I'd always stop by and say hi. And so one day I was over there, and Henry Winkler said, "Well, you have got to go anywhere?" And I said, "No." And he says, "Stay and watch this kid work. We've got a guest star. He's amazing."
Really?
You know? And so I said, "Oh, okay." So I stayed. I figured I'd stay 10 minutes and watch them rehearse. Well, I stayed the rest of the afternoon just so I could get this guy alone and tell him, "You're a genius. I love you. You're a genius." And so, you know, 8 months later, I get a call from the agent, and, "Oh, we have good news and bad news." And I said, "Well, what's the good news?" "The good news is you got that TV movie you wanted. Great. What's the bad news?" "Well, Gary Marshall has this new show, and it's all under wraps, and nobody knows anything about it, and nobody can find out anything about it, and he wants you to do it. They want you to just be recurring. They don't want to give you a contract. They don't want to pay you anything but top of show, and you're making so much more than that now," and da-da-da. And I said, "Well, what's the name of the show?" And he said, "Mork and Mindy." And I said, "Mork and Mindy? That's Robin Williams' show." And he said, "Who's Robin Williams?" And I said, "Robin Williams is a genius." I said, "Don't tell Gary. I'd work for free to work with Robin Williams."
No kidding.
And so so I did. You know, I mean, I went over there and worked for nothing and just to get to work with him.
I mean, how much of working with him was him ad-libbing and you trying to hang on for dear life?
Oh, no. Not for me, but for most people. And that's what I saw. I went over before. The show was not on the air yet.
Yeah.
I was like the fourth episode. And I went over to see them shoot the show before mine so I could see what all the character relations were.
Yeah.
And so I got there and watched that, and I could see Robin in the commissary at the dinner break with all his crazy hippie friends from Topanga Canyon kind of looking at me. And I knew they were thinking, "Boy, they sent me really Miss White Bread America here." And, you know, because, I mean, his whole group is like shaved heads with spikes,
really?
Purple hair, everything pierced, you know, in 1978. So anyway... So the next day, we come in, I do the read-through, you know, everything's funny, and then we get up and start blocking. And I see right away that what happens is there's a script, but Robin just goes off on these tangents. A lot of it is nightclub act, but just tangents. And nobody does anything. They just watch him go. And everybody is sort of sitting back watching him go because he's so brilliant. And then when he'd start to run out of material, which, of course, he would never admit he was running out of material, the directors, you know, would say, "Oh, well, let's get back to the script." Script, you know?
Yeah.
And meanwhile, the writers are writing everything down. And so so when I got up to start working with him, you know, we start off doing the scene, and he started off on something, and he was like, and I threw something at him, and he looked at me, and it was like, and then he threw something at me, and I threw something back at him, and he threw something at me, and I threw something back at him, and then he came over and grabbed me and threw me in the air and like said, "Mama, you want a me," you know? And so, but nobody was improvising with him. He was bouncing. He was going to the universe, and, you know, I was giving him something to bounce with.
I would think he'd be an intimidating guy to want to improvise with because he was so fast, Morgan.
Oh, no, he's so brilliant. And so fast. Well, yeah. It's like one time he had asked me, because we got to be buddies, and he was taping a special for HBO. I think it was HBO. Anyway, he was going to tape it at the Whiskey at Go-Go. So he said, "Would you come over and see the shows?" Because you're going to do two shows. I said, "Come on." So I went over, and I sat through the first show, and I went backstage, and he said, "They're not laughing. They're not laughing. Why are they not laughing? I can't do the second show." No. I said, "Robin, I'll tell you why they're not laughing. You're getting ahead of yourself. You're too fast.
Wow.
You know this material so well, and you're too fast, and you're not quite finishing the punchline. You're getting ahead of yourself. Slow down, listen to what you're saying, and let them catch up. But you're skipping the punchline because you're going over it."
Yeah, you're on to the next joke.
Yeah, and then he, you know, so the second taping went better because he started, you know, pulling back a little bit. I think he was so nervous.
So you could talk to him that way and say, "Hey, listen, you're doing great, but just slow it down a little bit."
Yeah.
Hey, we have a little clip here from one of your appearances on Mork and Mindy. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but we'll get a sense of Morgan Fairchild and Robin Williams.
Of Christmas.
Well, I'd like to meet my main munchkin.
Eugene.
Oh, Mark, I am so thrilled. Hello there. I am so thrilled that you and Mindy have invited me to spend this special time of the year with you that, well, I've decided to share with you one of my most cherished possessions. A heavenly top piece for our tree. My Gucci angel.
Well, any friend of yours is a friend of ours, and your winged guest is welcome here. Fly, little friend, be free. Oh, heavy remorse. I've killed your flighty friend. I'm sorry, it was your most prized possession.
That's all right, I have six more at home. Well, I must fly.
Oh, think of your friend.
So, when he passed, how did you react to it?
I was devastated.
Sure, sure.
I mean, now it's come out that he may have had early signs of Parkinson's, which nobody knew the day that he passed, or very few people knew. I was just devastated because Robin was one of the kindest, sweetest, most generous-hearted, do-anything-for-anybody kind of guys in the world. And you don't see it a lot in show business. And he kept that ingenuous kind of child energy about him always, even as he got older. And it's okay to lose some of the manic stuff, but he was a dear human being, you know. He was just a great guy.
And you had stayed in touch somewhat over the years?
I would see him off and on at different things because I do a lot of charity work too, and I would see him at different things. And we would always talk. I was really hoping that I, you know, when he had the new show, I could come play his ex-wife on that. I knew they were casting that. Just to work with him again. I just wanted to work with him again. He's such a sweetie.
Let's do this, Morgan. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll visit some more with the great Morgan Fairchild about her new production at the new theater restaurant, Murder Among Friends. It opens August 27th. It runs through early November. We'll talk about some of the folks she worked with over the years: Candace Bergen, Courtney Cox, Tom Selleck, Buddy Ebsen, and Pee Wee Herman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. This hour, we're visiting with the great Morgan Fairchild. She's in town for a production at the new theater restaurant. You know, lots of times, Morgan, when folks like yourself come in from the new theater, I sort of go through some of the folks you've worked with over the years that so many other people can recognize. Pee Wee Herman from Pee Wee's Herman's Big Adventure. You were part of that cast.
Yeah. Well, I'd first met Paul when I was hosting Night at the Improv. And the afternoon we had a rehearsal, everybody came in. Shecky Green was doing it, all these big And I didn't know this guy. But everybody came, ran through their bits and stuff. And this kid comes up, not as Pee Wee Herman, just this young guy. And he came in and he said, "I'm not going to do anything right now. I'll show you tonight. And I just want you to know, whatever happens, I won't hurt you."
Okay. What does that mean?
So I didn't know. Anyway, he came out that night as Pee Wee Herman, jumping all over the stage and throwing spiders and snakes at me. I've been in the theater so long, I'll just go with anything. And so he came over after. He says, "You're the first person I've worked with that went with it and played with it and had fun with it." And you know, la, la. So we got to be buddies and on different things. And so one day I get a phone call. And he says, "Hi, it's Paul." He says, I got a big favor to ask." And I said, "Yeah, what?" And he says, "Well, I'm doing my first movie." And I said, "Oh, great. And what is it?" And he says, "Well, we're going to do like kind of a thing of Pee-wee's Big Adventure." And so I said, "Okay." And he says, "Well, we really need some cameos. And everybody's turned me down. Huh. And we have no money, and it's going to be scale, you know." And I said, "Oh, okay." And I said, "So what do you need?" He said, "Well, could you do something next Thursday?" And I said, "Well, let me check with Falcon Crest." He says, "But there's no money." I said, "Paul, I got the no money part." You know? It's like, "But let me check, because I see if I can get off." So I called Falcon Crest and said, "Can you work around me that day?" And they said, "Oh, yeah, okay." But they were very nice about it. So I show up on the back lot at Warner Brothers, and they've apparently gotten permission to shoot in this little area of the back lot. And I get there. I have no script. I have not seen a script. Jim Brolin and I, neither one had seen a script. And so we didn't know what we're doing. But I get there, and they're doing a ninja fight. So I took him aside and I said, and Tim Burton was the director, first mm-hmm. movie, I think. And so I said to Tim, you know, I can probably do this ninja fight for you. I had all these years of kung fu in Chinatown. The only thing is I can't fall out of the tree because Falcon Crest will kill me if I break my leg. But I can probably do this for you, so we'll do that. You don't have to have the stunt double here. So we do the ninja fight. And then Jim Brolin gets there, and we're they take us over a few feet away and set it up. And, I mean, this is really like movie, guerrilla movie shooting, you know, and say, okay, just look at each other and say, I know you are, but what am I? And we said, what does it mean? It doesn't matter. We haven't seen a script. We don't know what it means. That's okay. It doesn't matter. It'll be funny. And we say, well, okay. So we stand there and say, I know you are, but what am I? And so then we get that. And so we're kind of finished. And so I said to Jim, do you have to do anything else today? And he said, no, I got the day off. I said, hey, I got the day off too. So I go to Tim and Paul and say, hey, you got us for the day. You want to do something else? And they said, what else can we do? We just got this part of the back lot here where we can shoot. What we can do? So Jim says, let me make a phone call. Now, he was shooting Hotel at the time, and I'd done the pilot of Hotel with him. So he calls Aaron Spelling, and they're not shooting on the Fairmont set that day. So he gets Spelling to loan us the Fairmont set. So now we've got a set. Now we have to figure out what to do with it. So we devised this whole thing of Jim being a big game hunter and Pee-wee's the bellhop and I'm a spy. And that's all just improvised with the set we had. And, you know, who knew it would be like a cult classic? But it was all just improvised, you know, just fun, creative.
And you were just along for the ride.
Yeah. You just try to help people out where you can.
How about somebody else, Morgan? Cary Grant.
Oh, Cary. I was one year I was going to host Chinese New Year for Caesar's Palace with Gregory Peck and Cary Grant.
Wow.
And Greg I knew, but I didn't really know Cary. And so we get out to the private plane to take us to Vegas. And Greg is on there, and he comes over, and he says, Morgan, you're a good friend of Willie Nelson's, aren't you? And I said, yeah. And he says, do you know how I could reach him? And I said, sure. But, you know, it's in my bag. I'll give you when we get there. So Cary leans around the edge, and he says, who? Who are we talking about? This is like 1984, 85, you know. Who are we talking about? And Greg says, Willie Nelson, the country singer. And Cary says, well, who is that? And Greg says, you know who that is. He's got so many hit songs out.
Yeah.
And Cary says, oh, is he the one who sings? And he starts on this song that sounds like On the Street Where You Live from My Fair Lady, but it's the Cary Grant version of On the Road Again. It's like, so then I get to, you know, I get to the hotel and I call Willie and I say, you know, Greg wants your number. And Willie says, really? What does he want? And I said, I don't know. He says, Gregory Peck is my favorite actor. I said, I know, Willie. And Duel in the Sun is my favorite movie. I said, I know. He said, maybe he wants me to be in a movie with him. I said, I don't know. Well, it turned out Greg was producing the Oscars that year, and he wanted him to be on the Oscars. And as big a thrill as that is to sing on the Oscars, I know Willie want to do a movie with him.
Is Cary Grant as devastatingly handsome as I've been led to believe? Because one of your predecessors at the New Theater was Diane Cannon, whose book on her life begins with this story about meeting Cary Grant for the first time, just how absolutely over the moon good-looking he was. And she walks into the room and meets him, and they talk. And then I just thought for fun, I'd ask Diane Cannon, well, you just met me 10 minutes ago. What's your first impression of me? How does that compare to Cary Grant's? And, you know, Diane has that hoarse laugh kind of thing. She laughed for 30, 45 seconds. You can still hear it on our archive somewhere. I survived that. But what was it like meeting Cary Grant?
Well, he was just knocked down gorgeous. But besides being gorgeous, he was witty and charming and smart and really talked to you. And, you know, he was just lovely besides being gorgeous. And that's such a winning combination.
Yes. How about Matthew Perry from Friends? Because you were on Friends. You had a good run there for a few years.
Well, I love Matthew. And the funny thing is, when they offered me Friends, I was just at that age where you start to make some transitions in your career, and all my girlfriends were saying, "Oh, you're too young to play that guy's mother. You're too young." And I'd been playing the mothers of, you know, first kids and then teenagers. Yeah. You know, it'd be the first 20 something I'd played the mother of, and I took the job, and they're all saying, "Oh, you're too young to do that." And so then when I got on the set with Matthew, I He said, oh, you won't remember me. I met you when I was a kid. He says, my dad, John Bennett Perry, played the sheriff on Flamingo Road and Falcon Crest, and I used to come to the set with him, and I thought, oh, I guess I could be this kid's mother.
You played erotic novelist. Who was your...
Nora Bing.
Mrs. Bing. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And it was great fun watching my poor son squirm. Actually, I was the first person to kiss a friend because my son catches me kissing Schwimmer Ross. And I was like the first parent on Friends, too. And we had a great time. We had so much fun. When we were shooting, actually, my favorite group was the rehearsal dinner and the wedding. Was great because they brought in Kathleen Turner to play my husband.
That's right.
And Gary Oldman was playing in a separate storyline with Joey, playing sort of a Peter O'Toole in My Favorite Year, you know, aging Errol Flynn action star kind of thing. And so it was great fun. And I would go over and watch them rehearse their scenes, a lot of which got cut. The Gary Oldman stuff got cut for time. And it was hysterically funny. I finally said to Gary, you know, you should be doing more comedy. You're so funny.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, darling, they never cast me that way.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And I know that feeling. But then when they brought in Kathleen Turner, I just thought that was hysterical, you know, that Kathleen Turner's going to be.
The voice.
And also, they always gave us great dialogue. I had a line there that I didn't even know they'd keep in. I thought that surely the censors would cut it, but they kept it. And
Morgan Fairchild's our guest. Again, she's appearing in the new theater restaurant opening up on August 27th, that production, Murder Among Friends. If you want to join our conversation, you can do it. 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. How about Tom Selleck from Magnum PI? You were on with him.
Well, I had done a TV pilot with Tom and Jerry Reed, the country music singer, like in 78, 79, something like that. And at the time, the pilot didn't sell, but I know the producer, because he told me this later. He went to the network and said, you know, this one didn't sell, but, you know, Tom and Morgan together, we should do a pilot together. And they said, oh, no, they're both so boring. And so, you know, and within 2 years, we were both like top stars on the network. So.
Yeah.
But and then I went back and did a Magnum with Tom, a crossover with Simon and Simon. And Tom is such a great guy. He's just such a lovely guy. Another Aquarian. I always love my fellow Aquarians. And just very low key, really just solid, nice, steady guy. You know, gorgeous. Again, gorgeous.
Yeah.
Knocked down. Gorgeous, but just a lovely, lovely guy.
Well, speaking of gorgeous, there was a time in your life when in 1982, Harper's Bazaar, Morgan, named you as one of the 10 most beautiful women in the world. You know, what's it like being named one of the 10 most beautiful women in the world?
Kind of a shock.
Was it?
Yeah. I
Even
mean,
at that
just,
point, because you were really
You know, when
deal.
You've grown up as the science nerd kid that's all white with white eyelashes and white hair and white skin and big, thick Coke bottle bottom glasses, you're always that kid.
Mm-hmm.
That, so that's how you always see yourself. So it's always sort of a shock if people are buying the facade.
In a weird way, is it a burden? That do you feel you've got to be beautiful all the time?
Oh, I gave that up a long time ago.
You're doing pretty well now.
Thank you, honey.
Yeah.
People judge you. You know, they judge you all the time. But you, after a certain stage, you just don't care. You know, they're going to do what they're going to do. And if they see you without makeup or they see you looking like a bum or see you at the grocery store, you know, hey, honey, that's life. Get over it.
Do you go out to the grocery store without makeup?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you're okay with that.
Yeah.
In the 80s, speaking of the 80s, you became this sensation, and maybe the best evidence of that is John Lovitz of Saturday Night Live saying this on Saturday Night Live.
That's a very good point, Dr. Ruth. Let's see, I think we have another question right there.
Hello, my name is Tommy Flanagan, and I'm a member of Pathological Liars Anonymous. Yeah. In fact, I'm the founder of that organization. Yeah, that's it. And I have a sexual problem. Yeah, yeah. Women, I mean, babes just can't get enough of me. Yeah, that's the ticket. Yeah. So then I moved, you see, to Hollywood, and well, that's where I met my wife, Morgan Fairchild.
What did you make of that?
Well, when it first started happening, I was doing Falcon Crest, and I was so tired on Saturday nights, mm-hmm. I didn't stay up that late. I didn't see it. And somebody came to work Monday morning and said, oh, they did this joke about you on Saturday Night Live. And I said, oh, what was it? And they said, I can't remember, but it was really funny. So I thought, oh, it's a one time. And a few weeks later, somebody comes again and says, oh, they did a joke about you on Saturday Night Live. It was really funny. I said, what was it? And they, I don't know. Was it a repeat? No, it's a new show. So, you know, I never saw it. So then that summer, I went off to Israel and shot a movie. And, you know, I was out of the country. And I come back, and he's still doing it. He's still doing it. So I thought, okay, I got to get this guy. So I knew his agent. So I got his home phone number. So I called him up, and I said, hi, John, it's Morgan Fairchild. And he says, no, really, who is this? Yeah, I said, no, it's really Morgan Fairchild. And he says, no, no, no. So we go like that for 10 minutes. Said, Sam put you up to this? You know, it's like, who is this? I said, no, it's really Morgan Fairchild. And he said, oh, I hope you're not upset. I hope you're not upset. I said, no, I still haven't even seen it. I just heard it. So I said, no, not at all. So we ended up getting to be buddies. And as his fame was exploding, you know, I'd be like his big sister and call, and we'd talk about, you know, how to handle some PR things and what to do and stuff like that. And so finally, I think he'd been nominated for an Emmy or something. He was coming up for the Emmys. And so I said, John, you're going to be in town. You know, let me take you to dinner. So he said, oh, great. You know, so we go to dinner. And the next night he goes to the Emmys and he's walking up the red carpet and people saying, you know, what have you been doing while you're here? He says, I had dinner with Morgan Fairchild. And yeah. He says, oh, yeah, sure.
Not kidding this time.
No, no, no. But nobody believed him. Then one time he called and he said, Morgan, I was doing a comedy club last night and I did something. I hope you won't be mad at me. I hope you won't be mad. I said, what? What did you do? And he says, well, I got carried away. I was doing my act, and I said, I slept with you. And I said, it's all right, John. I don't think anybody believed you.
Yeah, I saw her naked, he used to say. I saw her naked twice.
Yeah. But you know who gave him that bit? Yeah. Al Franken.
Oh, really?
He had the bit, but he didn't have a name. And Franken was a big fan of mine, apparently. Franken's told me this, and so has Lovett, so I assume it's true, that Franken's when it said, make it Morgan Fairchild.
That's funny. Morgan Fairchild's here, 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Let's go to some calls here. And Dennis from Kansas City, Missouri. Dennis, you're on with Morgan Fairchild. Good morning.
Hello, Morgan Fairchild.
Hello.
I just want you to make some comments on your playing Maid Marian, which is George Segal's Robin Hood.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the beginning of that. You just want comments on it? Or did you want to ask a question about it?
Pretty weird little movie, and I just want you to, you know, talk about it, because it was on CBS, I remember, and I thought, what is this doing on the air?
Oh, well.
But every time I see it now, I kind of like have to wear a adult diaper, because it's pretty funny.
It was a fun movie. The guy who had wrote Love at First Bite wrote this and as a spoof of Robin Hood before Mel Brooks did it. And it was fun. We had a great cast. Roddy McDowall, George Segal played the Robin Hood character. Janet Sussman, who'd been doing had done Nicholas and Alexandra, was playing Eleanor of Aquitaine. I'm Maid Marian. We had all, you know, Sir Michael Hurden and all these different sirs, and, mm-hmm. and a former Doctor Who, Tom Baker, was in it. So it's like a very eclectic cast. We were shooting in a 12th century castle in England, and I remember the studio had gotten George and me houses out in the countryside. So I had a house with sheep meadows and, you know, all of this, and they'd pick me up in the morning and drive me to work, and you'd come over the hill of the dew-covered fields with this 12th century castle to go to work in. And I thought, this is showbiz. I like this. This is what I want to do with my life.
Yeah, what a good time. Well, I wanted to go back in your career a little bit. We talked a little bit about your beginning. How did you get started on the soap opera? Because if you fast forward to 1973, you decided to pursue a career in television. Just 6 weeks after you moved to New York, you landed the key role of Jennifer in the daytime soap Search for Tomorrow. Were you thrilled, and how surprised were you to land that so quickly?
Well, it wasn't quite that way.
Okay.
I probably read that way in the bio. I'd gotten divorced. I'd moved up to New York, but I was still taking a lot of theater work, and it took me out of town a lot. And the 6 weeks is when I finally decided, you know, if I'm going to live in New York and pay these rents, I should actually stay here and see if I can get a job. So but nobody wanted me. I didn't have the right look. Nobody wanted me. I couldn't get an agent. Everybody thought I was.
What was wrong with the look?
They said I was too elegant, too porcelain, too glamorous, and we want real people. Man. And, you know, so I finally said, do I have to break my nose to get an agent? But it was so it was kind of a hard time.
And people talk to you very directly about your look and what they want and what you are and what you need to be.
Showbiz is a brutal business. That's why, you know, if there's anything else you can do and be happy,
yeah,
do that.
You go back to that.
So,
yeah.
Anyway, so I was casting around trying to figure out what I could do. And when I was growing up in Dallas, I'd done a lot of modeling. Now, I'm too short to be a real model, but I could do petite lines. I could do hand and foot modeling, beauty, cosmetics, hair, stuff like that. So I'd gone over to Eileen Ford, and they had just started a commercial division. And a lovely man named Gene Barricat was the head of the commercial division, and he liked the look for once somebody liked the look and said, oh, yes, we'd love to have you. And we don't have many girls who can talk. We have models and we don't have actresses. So one day he called and said, we've got an audition. This is such a big thing for us. They to crack this soap opera thing. And so we've got an audition for a soap opera. And would you go? So I go over and I read for this part that's going to be like a 3-day story arc. And I don't get it. Huh. But what I didn't know is that they liked me so much. They had somebody that just moved into for like 6 weeks into this Jennifer Phillips character, and they weren't happy with her. So suddenly, I'm Jennifer Phillips. Off of this audition for 3 days, I got a contract.
Wow.
And so Susan Lucci and I became the early bitch goddesses of daytime.
So. Is that hard work, soap?
Oh, yeah. I mean, each of these, if you're young and getting started in the business, there is no better training because they work you to death. You have to learn so many lines overnight, and you have to do it right because unless the scenery falls in on you, that first take is going to be it. And it's great training. I learned a lot of camera technique on that. I'd done so much theater, but I didn't have a lot of camera technique. I remember I would go in every day and watch the show in the control room. I'd get my little lunch and I'd come in and watch the show. And one of the other younger actors who was very disdainful about having to work on the soap opera would come in one day and said, why are you watching this stupid show? Why are you, you're wasting your time with this stupid show? And I said, well, here's the thing. I got married young and I didn't get to go to college. But if I'd gotten to go to college and taken drama, one of the things they would do is tape me doing scenes and then play it back for me to see what I did wrong. Mm-hmm. And these people are paying me to do it. Mm-hmm. I used it as sort of my college program to learn camera technique.
What was the hardest thing for you to learn as an actress? What was your personal biggest struggle to become a fine actress?
Well, some people would differ with you on the fine actress,
okay.
But... you know, the main thing is, well, my mother used to say, you look like you're scared to be out there. Don't do that.
Oh, really?
You look like you want to get off stage. Having to conquer that is the first step. Learning to be in the moment. A lot of the young actors I work with are doing what you would call indicating. They're acting it as opposed to feeling it.
Mm.
And they're not thinking it through. You know, they're not thinking about what they're saying. I've several young actors I've worked with over the years, I've had to sort of take aside when you're getting ready to do a scene and just say, why are you saying that to me? Oh, I don't know. Think about why you're saying that to me.
Mm-hmm.
And think about who I am that just walked in this door. What is going to be your reaction when you see me? What is your reaction?
It's too mechanical early
on. Well, yeah, because they just memorized the lines and now they're kind of walking through it.
Yeah.
And that's the whole thing because a lot of the kids don't have any theater training, so they don't really know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Back to some phone calls here. Victoria from Overland Park. Victoria, you're on with Morgan Fairchild. Good morning.
Good morning. I wish we had another hour with Morgan.
Yeah, she's terrific, isn't she?
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And finding out your interest in science and what you do for others and your follow-through, really impressive and humbling. And I'm going to go sign up to see you at the theater.
There you go.
Oh, great. Come back and say hi.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Thanks for the phone call. Yeah. Now, let's talk about something else very near and dear to us here at KCUR. You've done some radio. In fact, you did several episodes of CBS Radio Mystery Theater back in the late 70s. Where did that fit into your trajectory there?
Well, it was another way to make a living in New York.
Yeah.
I'd heard, because Hy Brown, who produced those, had an office in the same building in CBS, because I was doing Search for Toronto in the CBS building. So you would literally go into work in the morning and you'd run into Walter Cronkite and Dan Rather at the elevator, or James Brown, or Captain Kangaroo. You know, we're all in the same building. And so was High Brown. So I started hearing that, you know, you could pick up a little extra money. Now, you have to understand that I think the pay was $44 a show. So it wasn't a lot of extra money. But I looked at it again, because I didn't get to go to college. I looked at it as a great acting exercise to isolate your voice, to have to sell it all with your voice, with no visuals. And it was great fun, because the mystery theaters, we would do just like they did radio in the 30s and 40s with the sound effects. You know, you'd be right there with the clapping of the shoes right next to you and all of these noises. Plus, you got to work with all these great theater actors who would come in and do it just because they loved it. So you got to meet all these really good actors, Ed Gwynn and different people, John Redfield, who'd just been in Cuckoo's Nest, and all these different people that William Redfield, and different people that you got to work with. And again, it was a great isolating thing. And then they gave me my own radio soap opera. I had my own radio soap opera I did once a week. So it was great fun. I think when you're young, it's great to get all kinds of experiences that you can. Nothing is ever a waste. Everything will stand you in good stead later, sometime, somewhere, somehow.
And just finally, Morgan, and quickly, you're opening at the new theater starting the 27th. The production is Murder Among Friends. Who gets murdered?
Oh, I can't tell you that.
And what do you have to say about that?
I can't tell you who gets murdered. That would ruin the whole thing.
But someone's going to get murdered.
Oh, someone's going to get murdered. Oh, yes.
Yeah. Hey, it's been a pleasure to have
and,
you.
And always keep an eye on me, because I'm usually the killer.
Yeah. Such a pleasure to have you here.
Enjoy
your
you.
Time in Kansas
nice
City.
To you.